Tim Gable was a sailor who was caught up in an unexpected conflict with Iraqis 21 years ago. Tim was in the Persian Gulf on board the USS Stark when two missiles crashed through the hull. Tim and a handful of others spent the night in the water.
We thought we were dead, and, you know, twice now, it is, you know, once on the ship and then once in the water. And then to see that the three guys you were with being rescued and that you know that you're going to be pulled out of that water. And, you know, to this day, that's one of the greatest moments.
But 37 American sailors died in that attack. The Exocet missiles came from Iraqi fighter jets. It is one more event that helps trace the long conflicted history of mistrust between the USA and Iraq. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is produced by North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. It's co-produced and distributed by American Public Media.
This weekend, survivors and family members from the crew of the USS Stark will gather to remember their part in military history. The missile attack that took the lives of 37 sailors on that frigate was 21 years ago this week. The Iran-Iraq War was in its late stages, and the shallow waters of the Straits of Hormuz were littered with the hulls of sunken ships and tankers as a part of that war.
In 1987, the president made the decision to use American warships to keep the shipping lanes open. Shortly thereafter, the USS Stark was mistakenly attacked by an Iraqi fighter jet while patrolling the Persian Gulf.
So it's a simple truth we reaffirm here today. Young Americans of the USS Stark gave up their lives so that the terrible moments of the past would not be repeated, so that wider war and greater conflict could be avoided.
Tim Gable was an operations specialist aboard the USS Stark. It was just after 9. He'd finished his watch shift. He was sound asleep.
I don't exactly know what woke me up, though I assume it's a missile hitting about 4 feet away from me. But I did jump up basically into complete chaos. We were right below where the missiles hit, so we did not see the fire, but we definitely saw the smoke. The compartment started flooding with fuel, paint, and water, because as you know, every ship stores tons of things everywhere, and every void is full of something. So whatever it breached was coming right into us.
Were you alone in the place where you were sleeping there, or were there other people there with you at that moment?
There were probably about 15 to 20 people there. And the first thing, you know, we realized is that the main ladder out was blocked. And if you looked up, you could see fire. And the emergency escape was blocked. We could not actually open it.
So is there a way of describing for us where you were in the ship in terms of, you know, how far below the top deck, that sort of thing?
We were two decks below the top deck, the main deck. The missile came in the first deck.
You're in this room with a dozen or more other sailors. I mean, can you talk to these people? Can you guys say what's happened?
Absolutely. We're talking. First thing, you know, we did is tried to get on the sound-powered telephone, which is intership communication, and, you know, no one answered, obviously, because it was cut. So at that point, you know, we're just talking about what to do, and that's where we regrouped in the bathroom, the head, and I got fully dressed. This is one of the smartest things I did. I got fully dressed, including putting on my topsiders, my civilian shoes, because I would need them later, because it was about between 1,000 and 1,500 degrees where we were about to walk into.
But I'm amazed that you had the presence of mind to say, right, this is really bad. I'm going to get dressed. I'd have been
it's
running.
It's all about training.
Yeah.
Dick, it's all about training. You know every inch of that ship because, you know, you're trained to memorize these things for this exact reason, because you need to know how to get out.
I'm just thinking, though, what you're facing at this moment. There's fuel from the missile, there's paint, there's heat, there's water, there's smoke. Your two ways out of the combat berthing area are blocked. What do you do?
We had no idea what happened. We had no idea that we had been hit by missiles. This is peacetime. We're just thinking we hit somebody. With ships, they sometimes hit each other in the night. And we're very small. Frigates are very small ships. So the first thing we did is we regrouped in the bathroom. We got our emergency escape breathing devices, which everybody has one.
Are these like the kind of air packs that a fireman will wear?
It's a plastic bag with a little chemical mixture that you ignite, and it gives you about supposedly 45 minutes worth of oxygen, but in my case, about 10 minutes worth of oxygen.
And you're what, holding it over your mouth?
It's a bag you put right over your head and you wear it, yes.
So what's the plan now? What are you going to do next?
We're going to go up the ladder into the fire. That's the only escape. right where the missiles hit is where we ended up. Basically, it's electric, it's fuel. Actually, the aluminum was burning at this point, so it was white hot fire.
Tim Gable and two others held hands and walked up towards the fire. He remembers no screams or ship's alarms, just the sound of that fire. And it was pitch black, live wires sparking everywhere.
What we were trying to do is go to our battle stations. And my battle station was in Combat Information Center, and the ladder to Combat Information Center was no longer there. So I had no direction to go, and that's when I went into the ship's control berthing compartment, which was no longer there. It was just basically completely wiped out. It was bulkheads and bunks everywhere. At this point, not that I ever saw it, because I probably saw it in sparking, but basically it was completely wiped out and empty. And that's where I think 25 people died immediately.
You're describing a place where it's dark, there's sparks all over the place. You kind of know where you are because you're well-trained, but all the ways out have been, you can't get out of any of those ways. What
Correct.
Is going through your mind?
I'm going to die. I mean, that's when you know that I've lived a long life of 23 years and this is it.
Are you by yourself at this point, Tim?
Yes, absolutely. There was no one around. And at this point, I'm out of oxygen.
Do you keep this breathing apparatus of yours on?
I took it off once, but the acid smoke was just way too much, and I put it back on.
I mean, that smoke must have been just incredible when I think of what's burning inside the ship at that point.
Yeah, and I can still smell it to this day. I mean, it's burning plastic. It's just the nastiest of all smells.
So what happened?
I felt some water flowing. I knew at that point that wherever that water was going was where I was going. And so I followed it and jumped. And I basically thought I had just fallen into a hole in the ship and was stuck in a void, but it was the ocean.
Tim Gable didn't know it at the time, but he'd actually jumped out through the same hole that one of the missiles had made when it hit the ship. Now, when Tim does figure out where he is and what's happening, he sees that the hull of the ship is rushing past him. The frigate had been on a full power run to test its engines, and it was still moving very quickly through the water.
I saw a fire hose hanging over the side, so I tried to grab it, and I missed it, but I did yell, "Man overboard," at that point.
Could you see anything when you were outside the ship?
Oh, yeah. The Persian Gulf is a very beautiful place. You can see the stars, you could see things flying for miles and miles around, and I could see the ship leaving.
It's a part of your story that I hadn't anticipated, this notion that you jump out the hull and the ship's still moving. It's been hit with two missiles, right? You figure it's going to be dead in the water.
Well, right, and it hit the actual electronic suite where all the computers were, so it wiped out all the computers so that they could not fire weapons or stuff like that. But the engine compartment was completely fine, and they just kept moving, which is what they're supposed to do. A couple people in the water, you know, that's collateral damage. They really need to save the ship.
When you were in the water and realized you were outside the ship, what were you thinking?
Your survival rate in the water at night is low to none.
Even in the Persian Gulf, where it's kind of warmer than most places, right?
Right. I mean, in a cold place, you'd be dead right away just from the hypothermia. In a warm place, there's a lot of sea creatures out there. And the night, you'll survive. The day, you won't survive, because in the day, it's so hot, you'll just be baked to a crisp.
You've tried to grab a fire hose. The Stark goes roaring on past. You call man overboard. What happens next?
Probably about within an hour, I found a life ring.
At this point, is the ship out of sight?
Oh, it's gone. Long gone. There's nothing there. You know, you try to swim to shore. You can see shore. You can see things. But you can see for 16 miles, and I can't swim 16 miles. So after a while, you realize that you're just going to need to, you know, tread water.
And are you thinking at this point, Tim, that you're all alone?
Yes, I am. I'm all alone. Within an hour and a half, I did hear screaming, and of course I'm making noise too, and I have the ring with the strobe light on it, and I find Tim Porter, or Tim Porter finds me. And so Tim Porter was pretty badly injured on his feet because that he didn't put shoes on, so I gave him the life ring, and we just floated together.
After a couple of hours, Tim Gable and Tim Porter come across two other men, Bill Morandi and Bill McLeod. Between the four of them, they have two life rings with strobe lights. And they're watching all the activity in the air above them, and they think there's a war underway. They make it through the night, but then the sun starts coming up.
At that point, you know, you're really thinking, you know, how am I going to survive? It starts getting hot, and you know that this is going to be a very long time, and you're not going to survive this. And that's when we start assessing who's injured. And, you know, I realized that my hand was, you know, basically burnt to the bone on just the knife edge. But it hurt enough that I knew that something was wrong. That was the first time I actually knew I was injured at all, was after I felt the pain of holding something. I was holding the strobe light.
Maybe this is a stupid question, but do you think, all right, here we are, four guys, we're in the ocean and we're bleeding, we're going to attract sharks?
Absolutely. Sea snakes and sharks.
Sea snakes?
It was sea snakes. If they bite you, you're dead.
And when it starts to get a little bit brighter, can you see anything else? Is there anything else in the water where you are?
Nothing. And there was no ship. Every once in a while, you know, you'd see like a high-flying aircraft, which is, you know, passenger airline or something, but nothing that you could flag down.
And what are you thinking has happened to the USS Stark at this point, that it's gone down?
We were clueless at this point. No, I never thought that it went down, because when it went past, it was fine.
But the idea that they might turn around and come back and look for you, that wasn't...
I was hoping.
The four U.S. sailors floated in the Persian Gulf for 11 hours. When they saw a helicopter approach them, they got worried. Remember, they think a war's underway and they're about to be taken prisoner. As it turns out, it was two rescue choppers from Bahrain, bringing with them an unexpected gesture of courtesy. We'll talk about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. This weekend, the crew and family members of those who were aboard the USS Stark will gather to remember the 37 sailors who died in an Iraqi missile attack. This wasn't part of the current war. This was 21 years ago. The Stark was actually attacked by mistake as she sailed in the Persian Gulf. She was targeted by two Iraqi missiles in the latter stages of what was then called the Iran-Iraq War. Tim Gable was a 23-year-old operations specialist on the Stark. After the nighttime missile attack, he and three others found themselves in the water, nursing injuries and worried about the sun and the risk of sharks. After 11 hours, they hear the sound of helicopters.
You know, it's two gunships. They have the 50 cals mounted. And who they are is what went through our minds. First thing we're thinking again, that we were at war. And I can tell you, my first thought was that I was going to be a prisoner someplace.
Huh.
Only until they got close enough could I see their flag and recognize the Bahraini flag.
Right, but even at that moment, were you assured that they weren't going to pass by you?
Yeah, I mean, they were just right above us at that point. They were just hovering above us.
How did they get you guys out of the water?
They dropped a SAR swimmer in, who swam to us, and then they lowered a winch with a ring, and one by one they raised us up into the helicopter.
Did these search and rescue people from Bahrain speak any English?
Yes, they're broken English.
Yeah. There must have been a moment when you thought, this is going to be okay. This is actually going to turn out okay. What was that?
Yeah, I mean, it was the defining moment. I was the last man out of the water. And it was the defining moment, is that, you know, we knew that we were rescued. And, you know, to this day, that's one of the greatest moments.
Can you take me back and tell me what was in your mind, what you were thinking?
Well, we thought we were dead. And, you know, twice now is, you know, once on the ship and then once in the water. And then to see that the three guys you were with being rescued, and that you know that you're going to be pulled out of that water is a great moment.
Did they have food for you, water?
It was Ramadan. So
no food, no water?
No food, no water. However, they had an apple. That's all I needed.
An apple.
An apple.
I hear your voice catching as you tell me about this.
Yeah. Well, they, you know, I mean, they basically broke their tradition and fed us.
Tim Gable and the other rescued seamen were taken to the International Hospital in Bahrain.
They put us into the hospital, into a room, and I still remember to this day, a nurse from Texas gave us all a yellow rose. And I don't think about that much, except a couple days ago, someone was wearing a shirt with a yellow rose on it, and it just brought it all back.
Isn't that something?
Yep.
Did the people on board the helicopter, the people at the hospital, were they able to tell you what had happened to your shipmates on the Stark?
No, and the shipmates never knew what happened to us for 2 days.
I mean, no one said we got these guys out of the water?
They knew people were taken out of the water, but we were MIA at that point, missing in action.
Yeah.
There was a lot of chaos, and the ship was still on fire. So, I mean, they're still fighting the fires on the ship.
What was the moment when you were back together with your shipmates? I mean, how did that come about?
That was after, I think, about 2 days. I got, you know, I was on land, so I called anybody that I could call. And my parents, they were on a sailboat in the Caribbean, so I couldn't get a hold of them. So I called my grandfather, and it was all together a one-minute conversation. He said, "Heard about it. How are you?" I said, "I'm fine." He said, "Okay, see ya." Which I thought was funny.
Especially after what you'd been through, yeah.
Yeah. When I came back, and I, by the way, I'm completely gray with paint, covered with paint, and I look like a ghost.
This is paint that has spilled from the water, or what?
That has basically burnt on me from at some point.
Right.
Basically adhered to my skin.
So they can't clean it off at the hospital, right?
I took a shower, and it was the most painful shower in the world. At that point, your skin is abrased completely, so, you know, water hurts a lot.
And the paint's still on you. You can't get it off.
And the paint's still on me. And there's nothing they can do about my leg, because after 11 hours in seawater, my scar is open just like a prawn. And there's really no flesh to sew up.
So it just has to heal like that?
Yeah. And it did.
Tell me about the reunion, though.
Well, can't remember exactly. I think we were helicoptered, or no, I'm sorry. It was a motor launch out to the LaSalle. And, you know, I walk across the brow from the LaSalle to the Stark, and the dispersing officer met me, and he just started crying.
He thought you were dead.
Yep.
The other three who'd been in the water with you, Tim, did they come back with you to the vessel?
Yes, they did. But I think there was some confusion, and I think they had reported that they had found my body. You know, I had no idea. And at this point, you know, we knew there were a lot dead. And so every person you met, you were glad they were alive. And then you realize that you don't see this person or this person. And at this point, they really don't know, but they know there's a lot dead. It's I think it's almost 20% of the ship.
It was 37 sailors killed in that missile hit eventually. Wasn't that the number?
Yes, 37. And there was 222 with the air detachment. But I think it's without the air detachment, that's our normal crew that, you know, we've worked with for the last 2 to 3 years. So of those 37, you know, those were all your, you know, and that was my watch, by the way. I was off watch. All those guys were my watch team. It's like everybody you work with was dead.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. As soon as he got back on board the ship, Operations Specialist Tim Gable was put right back to work. And he didn't take time off.
There were certain people who immediately got medals, and that was a very nice gesture. I was actually not on the ship, so they didn't even know, you know, what I'd gone through to give me a medal. So I didn't expect at that point to get a medal. But then 2 or 3 months afterward, my congressman contacted me and said, I have a couple medals waiting for you.
Was there a ceremony?
No. They mailed them to me. Matter of fact, the Navy Marine Corps Commendation Medal never arrived. The box came, but it was empty.
That's bizarre.
It is. My grandmother, who's no longer there, was very unhappy that there was not a ceremony for me. You know, it would have been nice at later on to have had a ceremony.
Some kind of public recognition other than getting a medal in a box in the mail, right?
You know, actually, in my life, I think it's pretty much appropriate that you get a medal in a box in the mail.
I wonder how it was adjusting to civilian life for you, having been through this, you know, all that naval service, winding up with this horribly traumatic experience, and then boom, into civilian life. I mean, how much of it did you carry with you?
Well, in the military, it has complete control over your life. It's a very emotional thing where, you know, they control your life and liberty. Some of the people who died, you know, we actually were not very good friends. And I had a level of anger when I was in the military that I really feel that this whole incident completely washed away. And that I really, you know, stopped thinking of people in a way of a selfish way and really realizing that they all are just people trying to do what they're doing. And that was kind of one of the things I've taken away from that incident. The other thing is that, as my wife can attest, I am the most prepared person in the world. I carry a backpack that has an amazing array of things that I need. You know, I have 4 pens. I have a computer with every program I could possibly need, all the files I need for business. At home, I have a bag that basically has all of the things I would need to survive if, you know, I lived in California. It was kind of like an earthquake kit, but right. It was really more born out of the fact that I've been through an incident where it was really smart to have certain things with you, including, you know, an extra pair of shoes and stuff like that.
When you look back at the years after that sort of miraculous escape on the Stark, did you have any periods of post-traumatic stress, difficulty coping, that sort of thing?
The nightmares, absolutely. I mean, you can't go through that without, you know, thinking about it. I mean, that's it. But, you know, like I say, you know, yellow roses make me cry, you know, whatever.
Because that's what you saw in the Bahrain hospital.
Yes. Really, Dick, there is no healing of it. It's just you went through something. I mean, everybody in the world goes through a traumatic experience, whether it's a car crash or anything, and it's time, and you have to get on with life, and you know you can't dwell in the past. And in my case, you have to take the knowledge that you basically survived through training and luck, an amazing event. But on the other side, I think there is a level of adventurism. You know, I look back and, you know, I think, wow, I survived that. You know, that was an amazing thing.
Tim Gable was one of the sailors aboard the USS Stark when it was hit by Iraqi missiles back in 1987. It was Tim's wife who wrote to alert us to the anniversary this weekend. And if you have one of those life-altering moments in your family that you'd like to talk about, you can get in touch with me through our website at thestory.org. And you can also find out more about the anniversary this weekend, the memorial service for the USS Stark. It's going to be held in Jacksonville, Florida, this weekend. I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. I've talked with a number of people recently who have these odd job combinations. It started with a house cleaner who's also an author. I talked with a woman who works as an elementary school teacher and moonlights as a stripper. My next guest sort of fits into this category. Vito Martinez is a used car salesman who's taking a vow of poverty and celibacy to become a Franciscan friar. Now, Vito says he was a good Catholic boy. He was an altar boy. He remembers going to church when he was very young.
I just know that it was big, and there were a lot of statues, and the guy up front said a lot of things, and we stood and knelt. But throughout my life, the Catholic Church has always been a big part of my life.
Vito drifted away from the church as he got older. He eventually found that he had a certain skill as a salesman, though he will tell you that he's always been a bit different from the other people he knows who are in the business of selling cars.
Depends on who you ask. A lot of my friends in sales, they're the type A personalities, likes to tell you a bunch of BS or whatever, just so that he can make you laugh and maybe sell you on something. I'm more of a friendly kind of guy. I think that when people want to buy the car, they want to trust that who they're buying it from is actually somebody they can trust, and that means something more than just what the price of the car is.
Don't be bashful. How good are you as a salesman?
Well, if you talk to me as a sales guy, I'll tell you that I'm the best sales guy in the world and that I make more money than some doctors and some lawyers.
Is that true?
Well, that's what you're told. When you go into the sales profession, you're told stories about guys who make $200,000 a year. And that's true. To some extent, if I were to continue to work this year, I would probably make about $80,000 a year.
Do you like the work, Vito?
I do in many aspects. It's just fun to be able to talk to people.
You have to have a good eye, though. I mean, you've got to be able to see me when I walk into the dealership and say, okay, this guy may be looking for this kind of car. He may be looking for this kind of... He may have this much money to spend. I mean, that's a part of your job, isn't it?
It's a part of it, but are you looking for a car, by the way?
Not right at the moment, but, you know, at any time...
I just had to throw that out there. No, but if you're looking for a car and you come onto the lot, the way I would approach it is talking to you as if, you know, we're next door neighbors and we just happen to be meeting at the fence. There are times that I've done hard closes where I've really had to negotiate to get somebody to purchase a vehicle or to do something. I remember I didn't like it because if I didn't believe that the customer needed it, it was hard for me to sell it. And there are times where I just can't sell something or I just can't close a customer because I feel it would go against my better judgment.
So was there a moment, anyone that you can identify, Vito, when you thought to yourself, I'd like to do something else. There must be something more out there.
When I first was in the car business, I worked at a finance lot. You go in if you have impaired or you don't have any credit, and they don't worry about credit scores. They charge you an exuberant amount of money for the car at a high interest rate. And if you're lucky enough to pay off the vehicle, you have established some credit. And for the first 2 years there, I had convinced myself that it was, in fact, a way for people to rebuild their credit, and it actually helped people. After a while, I realized that this wasn't a place I could continue to work at because I would see so many people come in need of a vehicle, sign up and pay just ridiculous amount of money for a vehicle that wasn't worth maybe $5,000, and it made it hard for me to sleep at night. And I knew I had to do something else besides the sales business.
Vito Martinez says he didn't know what he wanted to do and that he stumbled on the idea of a return to the church almost by accident.
Even though I was making money and I had my girlfriend I was living with at this nice apartment, for most people, you know, you're set. For me, it was a really low part of my life because I wasn't happy like people told me I was supposed to be happy.
You're early 30s, you have a girlfriend, you have a nice car, you've got stuff, you've got a good income. I mean, you're right. These are the things that we're taught are heading us in the direction of a good life.
But when I looked back on my life and what I had accomplished and what I had, I couldn't see myself being happy this way for the rest of my life. It was a hard realization for me, but I realized that something had to change. And I spent a lot of time, instead of going out to the bar with the guys or anything like that, I spent a lot of time reading. I would go back and read my college books on Kierkegaard and Origen, and at work, I would go through Catholic apologetic material by St. Thomas Aquinas and read the Catechism of the Catholic Church. And one day I was just surfing on the internet. It was a website in the Diocese of Grand Rapids about vocations in the Catholic Church, and it talked about the priesthood. And it was some kind of like an army, we're looking for a few good men, I think was the ad.
So it's kind of a challenge to you then, was it?
Yeah, it was a challenge, but it was also like a moment of clarity of this is where you should be. Not really something, oh, this is what I would like to do, or, oh, hey, there's an idea. It was just a moment of understanding of this is where your life should be.
The thing about Vito Martinez's decision to re-enter church life, to take the vow of poverty and celibacy, was that he still hadn't told his girlfriend. I'll talk with him about that in just a moment. I'm Dick Gordon from American Public Media. This is The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story. In my series of conversations with people who hold down or who contemplate holding down these contrasting jobs, I'm talking today with a man who sells used cars and who's getting ready to enter a life of poverty and celibacy as a Franciscan friar. Vito Martinez says it's not that the car business is bad these days. He says that the high gas prices have a lot of SUV owners scrambling to get something smaller and less thirsty, so there's a lot of money still to be made selling cars. This is something else, he says.
I hadn't really considered it a whole lot in my past. I remember when I was an altar boy in high school, the idea crossed my mind, but it was never anything big where I debated being a priest. So this new concept of being a priest in the Catholic Church, and that's what I was supposed to be, was exciting, but it was extremely scary.
Yeah, I'm thinking to myself, you're living with a girlfriend, and you have a good life, and you're going to kind of cash all that in for a life of poverty and service? It's a pretty dramatic change.
It is, and it was something that I thought I wasn't ready for. I remember talking to the vocations director. I walked in, and we had a meeting, and he's a real good guy, and I said, this is what happened. I was sitting on my computer, and I'm just surfing the internet, and I had this moment of clarity, this religious experience. I don't know the words to call it, I told him. I had this experience where I realized that I'm supposed to be doing this. I said, you know, I think God picked the wrong guy because this is not who I am. You know, I think God's calling the wrong guy.
So what did he say?
He told me that my response is not out of line. It's historically how most men have answered their call. Jonas ran away from his calling. Paul was a persecutor of Christians before he was called. So it's not out of line for men who aren't traditionally God-fearing, worshiping people to be called by God. And he said that, well, your life is kind of out of the way of where it should be. And he said, well, the fact that you're living with your girlfriend and you're not married is a big issue. He said, but if this is something that you really feel is serious, that would be the first thing I would address. And you're going to have to tell her, and it's going to be messy, and she's not going to like it. But that's what's going to have to happen.
And Vito Martinez did tell his girlfriend, eventually.
I actually hid it for about a month. I had literature and prayers and stuff. But I believe it was one day that I just put it out there, and I said, you know, I don't know where this is going to go because I think I've been called to do something in the church, and it could be as simple as volunteering more, but I think it's going to involve maybe me becoming ordained. And in the Catholic Church, when you become ordained and you become a priest, there's no marriage, there's no living with anybody else. At first she said, oh, that's great, and that's wonderful, honey. You know, we'll get through it, we'll do what we can. And I go to work that day, and I think, okay, everything's going to be fine. You know, I'll just work through this. I'll go through my discernment, and I'll see where God's calling me. And if I end up going somewhere, we'll be okay. And I get home from work, and she is not smiling. And I realize, okay, she's had time to think about this. What ends up happening is a huge fight. She thinks that I'm not actually trying to be a priest. She thinks that I've found a way to get out of a relationship because I'm seeing somebody else.
Okay, but look at it from her perspective. She's going, I'm with this young guy. He's a car salesman. It's a good life. And now he wants to throw that all away and join the priesthood. He must be having an affair.
Yeah, and it was funny because it was exactly the way that he said. It was very ugly. There was a lot of trust issues. She didn't believe me. And the one thing that really hurt was the fact of her saying, if they let guys like you into the priesthood, then they really have problems.
Ooh, what do you think she was saying with that?
I think she was vocalizing my fears in that I wasn't a good enough person to accept this kind of calling. And that fear and that self-deprecating thought of me not being good enough, that stuck with me for a good 3 or 4 months of my discernment, of my trying to understand where I was going to go.
Well, okay, but help us with this a little bit, though, Vito. I mean, you are living with a woman and you're not married to her, and in the eyes of many churches, that's a sin. You sell cars. What other sins could she be listing off? Were you a party animal in your younger years? And she's saying, you know, you'd never make a good church. What's she saying?
We had a very physical relationship. I think when we got together, it was a real whirlwind experience. And by that time, we kind of knew that we were using each other. She was using me for the security and for what I had. And I was using her because she was there and able to cook and clean and obviously the sex. So it wasn't like I was anywhere near the holiest of people.
But basically what she's saying is you're not going to be able to give up sex. You're not going to turn into someone who's celibate.
Right. What she was telling me was that there's no way that I should have made up a better lie to get out of the relationship. It's it broke down.
Talk to me about the celibacy thing, though. I mean, that's a big deal for someone who has been in relationships and then is saying, okay, I'm ready to sort of be done with all that.
It is a big deal. And I think the easier part of it, if there's any easy part of celibacy, was because this breakup was so bad, I found it really easy to stay out of situations where I would be, you know, involved with another woman. I was so upset and just finished with the whole relationship that even if I didn't end up becoming a priest, I figured, oh, I'll live a good life as a bachelor.
Vito,
I don't need to worry about
Vito, one. Help me here. A good-looking woman comes into the car dealership, and you go, I'm not looking at that. That's not. No, I'm past that. Completely over it.
True, you're right. No, celibacy, it's hard work. It requires a lot of mental patience and
cold water.
Yes.
Discipline.
A lot of discipline, yes. Celibacy, giving up sex, it's a huge decision.
So this relationship ended.
Yeah, the relationship ended. And so I end up going back to the vocations director and I said, okay, the relationship's done. What's next? Yeah, I've got a little checkbook of things that I figure I need to do to make my life right.
I'm Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Story. Vito Martinez moved in with his mother, and he's been doing a lot of thinking about things like the importance of money and status. He was also checking out which Catholic order was the right one for him, and after the church's public scandals in recent years, they were checking him out too. So after more than a year of meeting with the brothers and participating in service projects and going through a rigorous application process, Vito was accepted into the Order of the Capuchin Franciscans, and he was accepted just a couple of weeks ago.
The Franciscans, they model their life after St. Francis of Assisi, who happened to be a playboy and was the son of a merchant in Assisi.
Another car salesman.
Yes, another salesman, but ended up giving away all of his things and chose to live among the lepers.
Is it tough to get in?
Yeah, it's not like a college application where you fill out an essay and put in some information. I had to dig up all kinds of Catholic information, such as my baptism, my confirmation. I had to pay off all of my personal debt. I had to take a battery of health exams, including an HIV test. I had to take my eye exam, a dental exam. Several psychological tests.
These psychological tests that you had to take to be accepted, what were they asking you?
I would get questions such as, Are you entranced by fire? Yes or no? Do you feel compelled to do certain things? If you had the opportunity to see a movie without paying, would you?
I hate those kind of questions because you don't know what the right answer is.
Yeah, you start thinking, should I put what I really think or should I put what they want me to say?
And then you're thinking to yourself, is what they want me to say what they really want me to put, or do they want me to put what they think I'm saying? Yeah, I know.
Yeah, the fun of psychology. What are they trying to get out of my mind? And after the battery of tests, I remember speaking with their psychologist, and he asked me, had I ever had any experiences of sexual molestation? Had I ever been molested as a kid? Talked about my sexual experiences. There was a fair amount of time spent on that area of concern, and for obvious reasons. And some of it was a little uncomfortable because I haven't spent a lot of time around a psychologist, but I made it through and it was a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I was going to say, that's more than I would have expected. Tell me, have you spent time with them? Have you spent any time in the monastery? Do you have even a sniff of what that life might be like for you?
Oh, yes. I've spent time with the guys on many different occasions on many of their different ministries.
And so did it have any kind of familiarity for you, Vito? I mean, did it seem, you know, like the best baseball team that you're ever on, or the, you know, the warmest moment at a Thanksgiving table? I mean, when you're testing out, do I want to spend the rest of my life with these brothers? Did you get any kind of sense of what's ahead for you?
It felt like a fraternity almost, which doesn't fit most of the people's ideas of what a religious order, but that's what I could best describe it as, is a fraternity. Obviously without the women and the heavy drinking, but it was a bunch of guys who were glad to be around each other. They were happy. They were joking.
Okay, so I'm kind of thinking of you like a graduate student at this point. You've just got into the course of your dreams, just got acceptance. When are you supposed to start?
August 17th.
So you've got 3 months to think about it. Can you back out? Can you say, all right, I've thought about it, I've changed my mind?
Yes, I could. I could back out. Even when I'm there, I could back out.
And what are you thinking? Are you having any second thoughts?
I don't know about second thoughts. I think the reality of going from the sales business, from being the person in charge of having fun every day, of being able to spend money, and then moving into this lifestyle of not having personal property, it's a transition that I'm still working on. I've spent many nights lying in bed in great turmoil, wondering if this is what I'm supposed to be doing. There are times where it's so bad that I can almost have tears coming from my eyes just because I'm so confused about what I'm supposed to do. But the best thing I can do is to just keep going.
You're listening to The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. In the time before Vito Martinez is due to report to join the Franciscans, he says he's hanging on to his old job.
I am still working at the dealership, and I'll probably be working there until the end of July.
And so when there are no customers around and the salesmen are, you know, gathered at the coffee machine, have you said, guess what I'm doing in August?
Well, I'm a small lot, so I'm just the only sales guy.
Right.
But I have a lot of colleagues in the business. And when we talk to each other, there's a certain level of, you know, when you're going to talk to this guy, 40% of what he's going to tell you is BS. So when we go in and I talk to him and I say, hey, how you doing? Oh, I sold this many cars and I made this much on gross. Oh, what are you doing, Vito? Oh, I'm doing this and I'm still looking at going into the priesthood and blah, 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 blah. And most of them took it with a, oh, he's just saying whatever. And as the day grows closer and I go back and visit these guys and I tell them, well, I'm just working till August when I actually go into the order. Oh, you were serious? Oh, you're crazy. You can't be serious doing that. No way. You're going to give that up? How are you going to go without sex? And I get a lot of jokes and a lot of ribbing. It actually strengthens my resolve because what I'm doing is going against the grain. Instead of holding on to that ladder of status and money, I've let go and just said, this is what I want to do. This is what makes me happy.
So have you told the customers who you're selling cars to that you're really only in this for a couple more months because you're going to join the Franciscans?
I always tell them after we've closed the sale, because I found that if you tell the customer beforehand, they assume that you're lying just to get their business. That's the mentality.
That would be a very creative line for a used car salesman. Buy this car because I'm going to be a priest in 3 months.
I'm sure they've heard quite a few whoppers in their buying experience, so I usually wait until after they've purchased the vehicle, and then I tell them, and they're very congratulatory, and they're very surprised to hear about it as well. They find something that they're not usually expecting to in a place where you wouldn't expect to find religion. You know, who goes and finds a priest when you're going to buy a car?
It leads me to my next question. I wonder if there's a part of you, Vito, that in a way wants to go to the opposite end of the spectrum to see what that's like, because you're in a business that's fueled on money, and sales is an industry that survives on that creative mix of truth and emphasis. And you're going into life where money's supposed to mean nothing, and you're not supposed to BS anybody.
Yeah, it's one end of the spectrum to the other. But even though that's what that life is, I've already made changes in my life. And by being honest and by being a better person when I'm selling a car, I'm kind of transitioning that mentality of money-driven, status-driven life into that Capuchin lifestyle.
So what you're telling me, in fact, is that your experience as a used car dealer is going to make you a better Franciscan brother?
I believe it will, and I know that's what the vocations director, Bill Hugo, there at the Franciscans has told me as well, is that by being a salesman, I won't be selling cars there. He'll want me selling the Word of God.
Ah, they have plans for you.
Oh, yes.
Vito Martinez joined me from Grand Rapids, Michigan. If you have one of these odd job shifts underway or a combination of interesting jobs that you're holding down, and if you're willing to talk about it, go to our website and let me know. You can find me at thestory.org. That's just what Vito did. By the way, Vito told me that one reason he considered a spiritual life was that he'd heard a conversation I had almost a year ago on The Story with a fellow by the name of George Wilkinson. Now, George was in his 60s. He and his wife had had a great life. They had 12 children. But after George's wife died, George chose to become Father George as a Catholic priest. Well, Vito heard that conversation, and it made a difference. Tomorrow on The Story, I catch up with the painter Beverly McKeever. Beverly is originally from North Carolina, but ever since her mother died 4 years ago, she's been living in Arizona with her mentally disabled sister. Now, at one point, Beverly went to see a special kind of masseuse called a Rolfer, and the person passed along a rather surprising message.
You have a lot of pain in your body from your childhood. You need to move back to North Carolina in order to resolve this pain and unblock what's happening in your body. It's time for you to go home, honey. That's what she said to me, just like that. And I was like,
Was there a little part of you that was going, oh my God, is she right? Do I have to go back? Like, was there a little part of you that's
yeah.
buying into this?
Well, you know, deep down inside, I was like, I knew she was right, but I just didn't want to face it. I mean, who wants to come home?
Beverly McKeever did come home. She is now back in North Carolina, face to face with the memories and also the family members who have inspired so much of her work. I'll talk with her tomorrow on The Story. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Story.
The Story is a production of North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.
American Public Media.